This is Pure Decking, show number 348 for Thursday, May the 9th, 1986. This is a show about stuff that interests me, like information security, rigging the game, and leaving cardboard stand-ups of Batman in strategic locations. I'm Morps, and tonight we have Madman. Madman, what are you drinking?
I'm drinking a monkey shoulder and an Alder... And an, I can't pronounce anything tonight. Arnold Palmer. They're separate.
And we have Aryu.
Well, the usual.
Cool. Yeah, I'm got back into that bottle of Knob Creek single barrel. Stuff's good. Anyways, just a little bit of station note. There will not be a Pure Decking next Thursday. Assuming we're doing IHN this weekend and, you know, the weekend after that, those should go off as planned, but during the week next week, I can't do decking, so that show will not happen.
So, Techie, you got tickets to the GIMP Festival?
Something like that.
Don't worry, I've hosed out the costume. You can have it back.
Oh, gross.
No, man. It's not the costume I was worried about. It's the cat of nine tails. Anyways,
the dishwasher's safe.
Yeah, cat of nine tails is dishwasher safe, totally.
It fucking is, man. You were around when Between the Sheets 2.0 was out.
Yeah, I was doing audio engineer for that one too, wasn't I?
Yeah, you heard the whole cleaning your sex toys edition.
They were talking about the fucking latex costumes being dishwasher safe. So, I mean, you know.
Yeah. Either way, I learned way too much that day.
I think we all did. We all learned a valuable life lesson that none of us really wanted.
I didn't. I already knew it, which was not to show up for that show.
It's variety, man. It's a spice of life, brother.
So I guess we'll open up with the obvious one. Firefox, past couple of days, had a bit of an issue. Just tiny little thing. All your add-ons quit working at the same time without warning. Just add-ons went away. And the best part is when Firefox disabled all your add-ons and you went and go see where'd my add-ons go, it started uninstalling them. It's like, hey, this is broken. You should take it off. Well, shit, right? So I talked to a few people at work who got bit by that and actually sat there and uninstalled all their damned add-ons because they thought they were broken. Because there wasn't any communication on it for hours either. Anyways, so yeah, going back to some of the third-party builds of Firefox, like your WaterFox and I think WaterFox was the 64-bit one, and then your IceFox, and there was another one that was decent, and I forget what it was. I actually switched over to Brave until it got fixed. Pale Moon? DPView says Pale Moon, so we'll go with that. I should read out the IRC. Actually, we have several people in the IRC tonight. We have myself, Sardonic, Psychros, DPView, Rats, Iron Angel, and the Madman. So, yeah, if we try to do the show live on Thursdays, except for next week, about 9 o'clock central-ish is usually when I start. So, you know, you can go to galaxy15.com, and we've got the IRC channel set up right there. If you're on Freenode, it's just Galaxy 15 Radio. Get in there and listen to the stream live, yell at me while I'm saying things wrong on the air. Let's see. So, I have Mozilla's write-ups here on their hacks blog. And I was going to sit here and go through it and explain it, but really, the issues was that the issue was that the an intermediate signing certificate expired. Whoops. And the certificate was the one that was Firefox was using to validate all of their add-ons back to the Mozilla add-on repository. I forget what they actually call it, but it's whoops. So because they were checking the wrong damn cert, they just disabled every add-on as being now broken, and so. They got the new certificate. They put out a patch. It took them a couple of days to get the patch written. In the meantime, they came up with a workaround to get everybody's add-ons working quickly. Mozilla has a system called the Studies system, and this is based around their data collection in the browser. You know, the first time you launch Firefox, it always says, "Hey, can we collect data on you?" And you rightly say no. It's like, I don't need my web browser shooting what I'm doing, everything off to Mozilla. But, you know, as opposed to Chrome, which just doesn't ask and does it anyways. But, although it's not to Mozilla, it's to Google. You know what I meant. So, anyways, because of this certificate expiring and all the Firefox add-ons getting disabled, the quick solution they came up with was to push out a couple of settings via their study system to disable certificate checks on add-ons altogether. But to enable studies, you had to allow data collection. So I turned it on to play with it just to see what it did. And it did, you know, after a little bit, get my add-ons back on. But now, of course, you're sending data to Mozilla and you're participating in the study system. Oh, and you're not validating certificates on your add-ons. So if you were smart, you didn't install any extra add-ons during this period because you had no way to validate that they were real. And you just kind of waited on the patch to finish up. And once they did issue the patch, you could turn the data collection back off, turn the study systems off, and it, you know, everything kind of goes back to normal. But it did take them a few days to get the official patch out. So they have the full write-up on the blog. It's an interesting read. It, you know, gets into a little bit of how SSL works, why they were doing it the way they were doing it, and, you know, you know, they and what they ended up having to do to fix it. And, you know, they've got some explanations in there. They've got a thing here, damage limitation. Once we realized what we were up against, we took several steps to avoid things getting any worse. First, we disabled the signing of new add-ons. This was sensible at the time because we were signing it with a certificate we knew was expired. In retrospect, it might have been okay to leave it up, but also turned out to interfere with the hardwiring a date mitigation that they discussed below, and they chose not to use. So, and then they immediately pushed out a hotfix, which suppressed revalidating the signatures on add-ons. So if you hadn't revalidated yet, it would prevent it from breaking. So, yeah, they just quit checking that add-ons were valid until they got a new certificate in place. So if you are not staying current on Firefox, you pretty much have to if you want to use add-ons because the certificate expired. Or switch over to a Waterfox or Pale Moon or one of the other Firefox, you know, either rebuilds or fork. So anyways, they have also, and I'll point this out, I've got a link to their Twitter account, the Firefox Twitter account. Because the only real fix, if you wanted to get back on Firefox in any length of time, as opposed to switching over to Brave or one of the other builds, was to turn on the telemetry, they are deleting all data collected since May the 4th. Because they know that most people who turned on telemetry were trying to fix add-ons, they weren't actually intending to send telemetry data back to Firefox. So I'm taking them at their word that they're actually going to delete this data, but Mozilla's actually got a fairly decent track record with this kind of thing. So I'm willing to give them the benefit of the doubt on that one. Like if Google or Facebook said they were going to delete all your data, you'd just kind of point and laugh because no, they're not. But, you know, Firefox, I kind of think they are.
That is kind of cool of them.
Yeah, but at the same time, guys, you're not managing your SSL certs, and you're a web browser. You write a web browser. Come on. And it was an intermediate cert. I get that. It's I mean, everybody fucks up their certs at least once, and then you go out and set up a Nagios plugin to check your certs and start giving you alerts at 90, 30, 60 days out, so that, and then, you know, start bugging you every day when you've only got a few weeks left so that you can get the new things out there.
I thought YouTube finally got around my latest ad block when that happened. Like, oh, fuck, they've gotten smarter. I wonder if the guys figured out a way around this yet. I got an ad today. I'll check tomorrow to see if there's an update.
Well, I tell you, man, living like a normie for 20 hours? Jesus fucking Christ, never again. I did not realize the internet had this many fucking ads.
No shit, right? You kind of get used to how the thing runs when you're running your uBlock, your NoScript, your Ghostery, and your HTTPS everywhere, and then suddenly you have to use it like a normal person, and it's just, you know, it's like, I have a high-end machine. Why is it running so damn slow? What the fuck?
Yeah, it was pretty bad, dude. It was like, well,
I don't remember there being pop-ups, pop-unders, and four banner ads on this site.
It's like, my God, what is this, Internet Explorer? So,
but to be honest, man, it gave me an opportunity to try out some different browsers, and I realized I am firmly stuck on the dick of Mozilla, because that is what I enjoy to ride. Fuck everything else.
Yeah, I mean, Chrome used to be pretty decent, but then they slowed the hell down, and they're doing crazy amounts of telemetry now, too, so. Although the Chromium builds are still supposedly clean, I haven't actually looked at them lately, truth be told. Rats Quantum? Yeah, no, Quantum is the current builds of Firefox. I think if you're not on Quantum, you're running that legacy build that they stopped working on before they swapped engines. At least I don't think they're patching the old Firefox. I could be wrong. I mean, but anyways, yeah, I'm wondering how many users they permanently lost to things like Brave and WaterFox because of this. It's actually not the first time Firefox broke add-ons, though.
Has anyone played with Brave? I've never actually looked at that one.
Oh, yeah. I use it as backup. It's decent. I've noticed some websites still don't seem to render quite right on it, but I don't use it all that deeply. So, does Brave have add-ons yet? That's a good question, because it had a built-in ad blocker that was working fairly decently when I used it, you know, the last couple of days.
Yeah, AdBlock and NoScript are pretty much...
Sorry about that. Let's see. So, features, Brave. Yeah, they're saying it's faster than everything else, too, which, when I was running it, I did notice it was faster, but I think that's because it's actually, you know, not running as much of the engines. Now supports most Chrome extensions, so apparently Brave can run Chrome extensions. Although I think Brave is still based on Chromium under the hood. They've just, you know, really done a ton of customization on it. Let's see if they tell me that on their website, because I don't remember now. I was thinking it was. Just Brave engine. Brave is based on Chromium. Yeah, I thought it was. So, anyways.
Can you unclick the data collection thing now and it won't fuck up?
Yes.
Awesome sauce.
Yes. So, actually, I disabled the data collection thing yesterday and it didn't have a problem.
To be honest, man, I totally forgot about it until you were saying something.
What?
I just went in there to check, and I was like, oh, fuck, I've been walking around with my fucking flyer undone.
Well, that's what DPView in the chat room thinks, is that they were kind of hoping that a lot of people would turn it on to fix the problem and then forget that it's on.
Yeah. I had, to be honest, man, I totally forgot about it, you know? I had other first world problems to concern myself with.
Yeah, like not ruining your back.
Yeah, I wanted to grab a cheeseburger.
I mean, yeah, I do like the rumor mill, though, that it was to get rid of Dissenta, that plug-in.
Yeah.
That was one of the good rumors. And I'm going to stick with that one.
So, do we have
what did that plug-in do?
Dissenta, I didn't really get into it much, but it pretty much gave you an open message board for every website. So even if comments were disabled, if a user had Dissenta, they could still comment on Dissenta. And other people who had Dissenta would come to that website, they would see your comments on whatever it was. And there was no monitoring at all. There was no mods or anything like that. You said it stayed up there. It was like, say whatever you wanted to say. It was
now,
great.
Now I wonder if Dissenter's back on or not.
I don't think it is, but then again, I don't use it, so.
That actually sounds pretty cool.
Yeah.
Private message board.
It's YouTube comments across the internet. I don't really know that it was.
Well, that's what I mean. I had it for a little bit. I was just sort of like, you know what? I got 4chan. I don't know. Maybe I should have kept it. Even if I didn't use it, it just would have been good to still have it.
Yeah, looks like it's been cut off, and you'll have to go grab it and add it manually, because I don't see it showing up anywhere.
Yeah. I think you can add it manually to Firefox, but I know you can't do it to Chrome.
So...
always find out about good things too late.
That's the way it usually goes, right? So, next article. This one is from The Verge. And game studios will be banned from selling loot boxes to minors under a new bill. On Wednesday, Senator Josh Hawley, I'll get it right, announced that he would be introducing a bill banning manipulative designs in video games with underage audiences, including the sale of loot boxes. The legislation would, if approved, prohibit the sale of loot boxes in games targeted at children under the age of 18. Games marketed towards wider audiences could also face penalties from regulators like the FTC if companies knowingly allow children to purchase these randomized crates. Quote is, social media and video games prey on user addiction, siphoning our kids' attention from the real world and extracting profits from fostering compulsive habits. Hawley said, No matter this business model's advantages to the tech industry, one thing is clear. There is no excuse for exploiting children through such practices. Regulators would determine whether a game is targeted at minors by considering similar indicators that they already use under the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act. Subject matter and the game's visual content would help regulators determine who the game is marketing toward. So if you're going to put loot boxes in your games, put tits. That way it's already automatically targeted towards, 18 plus. And
hey, good news. We must have solved every other problem on the planet. We're discussing a Congress intervening in video games. I had no idea that we'd solved poverty in the U.S. or homelessness or Social Security going bankrupt in 12 years. But apparently we have. Sweet.
I just envision it like, how many websites to say, are you 18? Yes.
Oh, yeah, this is going to stop nothing.
Pay-to-win mechanics in games targeted at minors would also be outlawed under this legislation. This includes progression systems that encourage people to spend money to advance their game's content at a faster pace. Hey, now, if you have a job and not that much time to game, pay-to-win systems are fine. It's only when you're in competitive multiplayer that pay-to-win really gets obnoxious.
Yeah.
Let's see. These games are often available for free, and certain levels or tasks are easier to overcome with a stronger weapon or ability that can only be obtained through microtransactions. Would also apply to multiplayer games that empower players who spend more microtransactions to more easily compete against those who don't. When a game is designed for kids, game developers shouldn't be allowed to monetize addiction, Hawley said. Damn. Some harsh language. When kids play games designed for adults, they should be walled off from compulsive microtransactions. Game developers who knowingly exploit children should face legal consequences. I think anyone exploiting children should face legal consequences, whether they know how to code or not.
What the fuck is your child doing playing a fucking 18-plus game to start with? You as a parent are a piece of shit for not monitoring your child.
I need to go clip out that I don't even know what he's really from. I think it's like an old Vine video of the guy just yelling, "Where are your parents?"
Yeah.
Just need to clip that out and keep that handy on the soundboard.
That's all that is, man. Like, why are we... This is a parenting issue. This is not a government issue.
Loot boxes.
I do like the banning pay-to-win competitive play or multiplayer.
Well, they're just banning. They're banning pay-to-win altogether.
Almost okay with that. I really think it's a problem. Competitive and multiplayer. The other ones I don't care because it doesn't affect me.
Yeah, I mean, if somebody wants to pay more and get through a single-player game faster or even a team game, like where it's all co-op and the only people you're really, you know, affecting is you and your group and you're all willing to deal with that and you don't, who cares that you're, you know, unfair to the computer? I mean, that's kind of what the computer's for in video games, right? So
yeah, it's for murdering. I've killed thousands of robot cops in my life.
Cultists are for killing. I mean, you know. Let's see. Loot boxes
and Murlocs. Those suckers just breed to die.
Well, I mean, you know, I'm certain, Mad Men, you still wake up in cold sweats with that sound. Anything that even remotely sounds like that sound, you know, hiding under the bed.
Oh, God, they've respawned.
Yeah, loot boxes and microtransactions are prominent features in mobile games, but the trend has made its way into big-budget games like Overwatch, PUBG, and FIFA from AAA studios like Blizzard and Electronic Arts. Fortnite sold loot boxes for some time in its Save the World mode, but they were removed earlier this year. The leading video game trade industry, the Entertainment Software Association, responded to the proposal, saying that other countries have determined that loot boxes do not constitute gambling. Something they've been criticized for resembling in the past. We look forward to sharing with the senator some tools and information the industry has already provides that keeps the controls of in-game spending in parents' hands. ESA acting president and CEO Stanley Pierre Lewis said, parents already have the ability to limit or prohibit in-game purchases with easy-to-use parental controls. I'm sorry, have you not seen what most parents do anymore? It's like the child's crying, handed an iPad. I mean, you know.
iPad, a credit card?
Yeah. It's like, here, go play, you know, pop the bubble, and, you know, every pop costs five cents or something like that.
I'll say there may be controls there. They are not easy to use, and they are not cross-system.
No, the control is you don't put your credit card on your account, so that when the child wants to buy something, they have to ask, and you can look at them strangely and say, no, why would I pay money for that?
Like, I'm not paying money for your video game character to have a costume. Play the game, you earn the costume.
Yeah, Timmy, you put that 1,000 hours a month in.
I'm going to go pay money for my video game character to have a costume.
And then
you
I'm
need to go mow the lawn.
But at that point, though, it's your money. If you want to blow it on something stupid, that's up to you.
Yeah. Like, this is a parental issue, man. It's not a government issue.
Yeah.
That's all I have to say on it, I think.
Let's see. The rest of the article. New rules would be enforced by the FTC, which has already reported an opening investigation into the sale of loot boxes after Senator Maggie Hassan questioned the commissioners over the practice last fall, February letter, blah, 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 blah. First few months in the Senate, Hawley caught critical eye on social media companies, blah, 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 blah. Okay. There's nothing else in here relevant. He's proposing a bill. It hasn't actually passed. They're just debating it. But, you know, I'm kind of like, well, I'm trying to decide, one, do I care enough? And two, should this be a law? Because you have to remember, when it comes to a law, that means eventually it will be enforced with force. Like, you will, if you make something a law, it could potentially escalate to the point where the cops are nightsticking somebody for not complying with it. I guess technically at that point they're not complying with, you know, they're resisting arrest for not complying with the other law or whatever. But I mean, you spin it however you want. Eventually, somebody's getting nightsticked if you make it a law to enforce it, right?
No, oh, I can just. There's an easy way to fuck with EA and Bethesda now. Petition your local fucking, you know, senator to go, no, that game is directed at children. I want microtransactions taken out or the company gets fined.
Actually, you know what, I mean? You know what this might really be? Hey, EA.
Fuck.
Hey, EA, Activision. Why aren't you I don't see your names on my donor list. I'm going to pass this law that's going to fuck over your business model because I don't see your names on my donor list. You know, that might very well be what it really is.
Yeah. I mean, what a way to fuck with Bethesda for their next Skyrim release. Come on, it's a fantasy game directed for young adults. They're not actual children.
Bethesda.
But they're not exactly over the age of 21.
I was just
reviewing. I bet there's going to be loot boxes.
Yeah. Bethesda.
I don't think there's loot boxes in Skyrim.
I was just reviewing my donors list, and I don't see your name on here. I'm going to start banning your business practices. I mean, this very well could just be government going for extortion, you know?
Yeah. Yep.
But as far as should it be a law? No.
No.
It shouldn't be a law.
Yeah. Because
it's not worth imprisoning somebody. It's not worth fining somebody. Parents just need to be parents.
100% agree. The iPad is not a substitute for a babysitter. But if you ever see children out in public, that's what they're doing. The parents get tired of listening to the kids scream, so they hand them a phone and tell them to go play Fortnite. Although, I guess...
It's easy. Talk to the kid. If you talk to the kid, they stop screaming. Most of the time. Sometimes they just need to be beat.
You just get you a bottle of nap time and a rag. Of course, I'm also an advocate of, you know, crating your children. So, anyways,
on it's cheap.
I mean, you always read these articles about how young children don't know the difference between dog toys and pet gates are the same thing as children gates, but they're cheaper. So,
dude, it's a conversational starter. Hey, why is your kid in a dog crate? Why is your kid not in a dog crate?
Your kid's on a leash, yeah? He's not going to get away from me, is he? It's like, yeah, but should you have used the choker collar, I'm wondering?
Getting him in the right fetish is young.
Oh, madman.
Oh, madman.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over.
Hey, you're the one that brought up a choker collar and a child. It had to go that way.
I was thinking in terms of like when you discipline a dog, but okay. You want to make it weird.
Well, I was going the other way.
You want to make it weird for everybody, go right ahead.
I'm not going to put a kid on a leash. They're already going to have enough hang-ups in a Catholic family without, you know, bringing bondage into it. They're going to learn. You either stay where I tell you to stay, or you're going to get hit by a car. Now, they may or may not survive learning that lesson unless you... That's why you have more than one kid. The rest of them learn from the idiot getting hit by a car. Now, see? Daddy told you to stay next to Daddy. Did Daddy get hit by the car? No. Junior over there, dumb fuck, got hit by a car. Now, let's go help your brother. Hopefully he survived. Any of you A negative?
Madman just became a proud father today. The kid's 5 years old, but he was pretty boring before.
Yeah, I wasn't proud before that. He was fucking boring as hell. Now he's entertaining. I don't know if he'll ever eat out of a, you know, plate again or get married, but the dude's hilarious.
That got rather dark.
I thought we were talking about the one that got hit by a car.
Yeah.
I'd actually be proud of the ones that didn't.
We'll go with that.
Depending on the age, they do bounce.
Yeah.
So if you're going to get that lesson, life lesson, do it early.
Maybe we'll get lucky and it'll be a low rider. So, you know, rather than getting brained, they just, you know, walk funny. Yep, that got dark. Next article. This one's from TechCrunch. The FBI have arrested several people suspected of involvement in running Deep.Web, a website for facilitating access to dark web websites and marketplaces. Two suspects were arrested in Tel Aviv and Ashdod, according to Israel's Tel Aviv police, which confirmed the arrests in a statement earlier in the day. Local media first reported the arrests. Arrests were also made in France, Germany, and the Netherlands. A source familiar with the operation said a site operator was arrested in Brazil. Deep.Web is said to have made millions of dollars in commission by offering referral links to dark web marketplaces, available only at .onion domains over the Tor network. Tor bounces internet traffic through a series of random relay servers dotted across the world, making it near impossible to trace the user. Its .onion site displayed a seized notice by the FBI setting U.S. money laundering laws. Its clear web domain no longer loads. The Tuesday's arrest follows an operation by U.S. and German authorities early in the week that took down the Wall Street Market, one of the largest remaining dark web marketplaces. Thousands of sellers sold drugs, weapons, and stolen credentials used to break into online accounts. Efforts to reach Deep.Web over encrypted chat were unsuccessful. A spokesperson for the Justice Department did not have a comment, while the FBI declined to comment. A spokesperson for the Israeli constituent in New York did not respond to a request for comment. So...
Your deep dark web is the equivalent of dark web Google. It's not actually selling any of this shit. It's just saying, here's the website you go to.
Well, that and they put ads on it and people would pay them for placement. But yeah, pretty much. It was a phone book. It was an index. I like where they're going in the chat room. It's like, you mean it wasn't already an FBI honeypot? Actually, it's more surprising that they didn't turn it into a honeypot. I mean, the FBI's done that before. They ran a kiddie porn site for months doing that shit, right?
Yeah. It was a fucking joke.
So, I love all the logos on these seized pages. I mean, it's like, and I don't even get the point of putting the seized page up. I would think that they would continue to run the site and start collecting information on people using it and determine whether or not what they're doing is illegal, right? So, but they're... DPView's right. They're going after basically every marketplace they can on Tor now because they're just assuming that all of them are 100% illegal no matter what, which I guess if you're running a marketplace on Tor, it probably is, but still. I'm not saying it has to be. I'm just saying the likelihood is high.
It doesn't have to be, but I'm betting that it is. Because you wouldn't want it on Tor if it wasn't illegal. Because yeah. You're limiting your audience on who can buy your shit.
Not only that, but one of the ways you break Tor is by getting code to run on your target's machine, right? Because depending on how they're doing it, if they've just pulled down the Tor browser and they're running it on a Windows box... If you can get an exploit in the older version of Firefox that the Tor browser uses, and there are plenty of them, you know, that's been a common trend, right? You can usually identify who the user is by getting their machine to make a clear text call. Now, if you've gone out and actually set up a proper dark web machine and you're maintaining proper OPSEC when using dark web stuff, it's a hell of a lot harder to identify who you are. The Onion protocol doesn't, I mean, it's not perfect, but there are ways to attack it, generally by setting up lots of onion relays, so you can start trying to correlate traffic, and we think the government's been doing that. I mean, for God's sake, the Navy helped fund Tor in the first place. But I mean, the protocol itself is fairly good. It's usually getting other things to go after it. Like Hunix is a pretty good way to use Tor, where you've actually set up the proper, you know, virtual machines in the router so that it's all encapsulated and isolated so that your client machine is actually not capable of making calls outside of Tor, shit like that. Yep, Rats is mentioning Cubes OS. Cubes is actually my preferred way to use Hunix. Hunix itself is kind of a pain in the butt to set up, but a Cubes desktop is actually, it's fairly simple and straightforward, so... Cubes itself is kind of a pain to use, but it is my favorite way to do that. And if you're doing things like this where you routinely need to maintain that kind of operational security with what you're doing. Cubes is a fantastic operating system for that. I will, about once a year, I'll get paranoid and decide to load Cubes on one of my laptops and try to run with it for a bit, and usually get frustrated with it after a couple of days and format it and put, you know, a more sane Linux on there. But every once in a while I play with it, and it's every time I've done it, it's gotten better, right? And the modern builds of it, especially with some of the enhancements you've been seeing for KVM machines with graphics card crack pass-through and stuff like that, you could fairly easily build a dedicated Cubes machine and having it have a gaming VM and even a Windows VM inside the KVM infrastructure that Cubes uses. It wouldn't be perfect for the way they run it, but you could absolutely do it if you were willing to go through the effort of doing it. I don't know. I mean, you need to be doing... I mean, everyone should practice OPSEC, right? But you need to have a reason if you're going to run Cubes full time, because that thing is a bitch to use. So, I don't know. But, I mean, hell, they still have people who just fuck up and log into their IRC accounts and other, you know, site accounts over the ClearNet every once in a while. And no matter what your setup is then, if you're not paying attention, you accidentally log into IRC from your ClearText IP, you're fucked, right? So, what's Red's
talking? I mean, I'm preoccupied here right now. The New York Times seems to be making a critical error.
Go ahead.
Allowing user input and banners on their website. It's something. It says describe yourself, and it lets you describe yourself in five lines. And some of the lines are getting pretty good. Like, I'm a black gay movie obsessed roller coaster journalism who likes to take selfies. Yeah, it's starting to get a little interesting. If it gets better, I'm just waiting for somebody to figure out
code injection on there and start, you know, just pwning people through the fucking New York Times. Rats wants to build a Cubes daily driver out of a server motherboard, onboard graphics for the GUI, and discrete GPU pass-through for gaming to Linux or a Windows box. You know, the DirectX emulation or DirectX to Vulkan translation has gotten a lot better. So you could reasonably do that on a Linux box, but if you're going to go through the trouble of setting up a VM, you might as well go ahead and do the Windows. That said, there's nothing to stop you from running multiple Windows boxes, and you know, you don't have to do GPU pass-through on all of them. But or as long as you remember to, you know, only run machines that, if you do GPU pass-through and you have multiple machines that use it, you just have to remember to shut one down before you run the next one. But if you are going to do a Cubes build, you want to make sure you have plenty of RAM. That's been my Achilles heel with it every time I've tried to run it. I tried to run it on a laptop that only had 4 gigs of RAM a couple of years ago, and I got it to work. But after the third virtual machine, the whole thing just choked out, right? Now, my current laptop, which was actually a cheaper one I got off Amazon, it was an Asus. I forget the model number now. It was one of the cheaper ones with an i5 in it, 8th-gen i5. And I was able to plop 16 gigs of RAM in that and a couple of SSDs. And it actually did run Cubes much better. But like I said, I got frustrated with it and ended up just putting a... Actually, it's running Parrot right now. But I've been meaning to actually play with Pop! OS, of all things. I just haven't had the time to do it. So I might dig into that. But...
The Cubes would let you run both Windows and Linux on it.
Okay, so Cubes is a Linux desktop that's built on top of the Linux kernel virtualization facilities. They designed it from the ground up with the idea that what you're considering a desktop would actually consist of multiple virtual machines running separate systems. So your machine has its own built-in router running as a virtual machine, which is why Hunix is so easy to use. You just spin up a Hunix machine, and now you can designate one of your client VMs to go through it because you can control the networking through a nice little GUI they've put together. It's actually fairly easy. They have a U-mounting system, a cloning system for the virtual machines where you have like a source image and you can spin up multiple copies of the same virtual machine without chewing up a lot of disk space. And it integrates the GUIs quite well by sharing the windows all on one single desktop through Remote X trickery. So because it's all based on virtual machines, you can put Windows and Mac virtual machines into this mix and run these on the same machine, right? So if you happen to have enough grunt to run a virtualization server, so if you're using server hardware, for example, or you've just got a really beefy desktop, you know, I mean, granted, a nice Ryzen or Intel Core i7 or i9 build could do it. You'd be better off with something like high-end Xeon workstation hardware or a Threadripper build. The problem there is you're getting into a $4,000 desktop build, right? So your better bet is to get on eBay and find some decommissioned servers from where they've been redoing data centers. You can get things like Dell R710s, and there's some HP servers, stuff floating around. Supermicro stuff is all over the place. So you can get a bunch of server hardware fairly cheap. Good luck finding a case it fits into, so be ready to construct your own case. And build a dedicated cube. So, in fact, that'd be a fun project, actually. I've got some... What board is that? That's like an HP workstation board I've got stashed downstairs with a couple of old Xeons in it. I want to say something like 64 gig of RAM on that board, too. I'll bet that would make a nice cubes workstation. May have to play with that. But if you're using the right main board, you could put a couple of extra GPUs on it and, you know, set those up for passing through to virtual machines so that you would be running a Windows virtual machine with its own graphics card. Because graphics is about the only area that virtual machines kind of suck at. Everything else in a modern VM infrastructure today, whether VMware or KVM or whatever, you know, CPU, networking, input, output, they're fine. Graphics is about the only thing that really hasn't caught up in virtualization. So with KVM on a Linux machine, it's not an unknown quantity. I don't want to say it's trivial to pass a dedicated hardware graphics card through to the virtual machine. So the virtual machine sees it as a real graphics card because it is, right? And if you account for that, like say having a second monitor on your desk, which is usually what you have to do for this, or a KVM switch or something, you can, you know, of course run your virtual machine with a second output onto a dedicated monitor for it and, you know, have your Windows VM running on top of a Linux workstation so you can kind of use whatever you want. The other way you could do something like that if you don't want to use cubes is you could actually load, because I've played with this as a build before too, you could load something like VMware ESXi onto their hardware if your hardware will run it correctly. Then set up a virtual machine that's going to be your quote-unquote desktop. And, of course, you pass through a couple of the USB ports and your graphics card and your sound card to the desktop virtual machine that is set to always run at boot. And then you run your virtual machine manager stuff from there. And that way everything's happening in a virtual machine, but it performs like a desktop. I don't know if I'm explaining that well. So that's...
Yeah, you're all right.
So
I was just thinking it'd be a cool way of doing... The only reason I'm still running Windows mainly is video games.
Yeah.
So I could do internets on a Linux build and just pull up Windows for the video games that...
Yeah. No, I see where you're going with that. And DMVK, which is the compatibility layer that goes on top of Wine to let you run DirectX games as though they're Vulkan... is getting really good. So I think in another year or so development, you will be able to run Windows games on Linux without too much of a headache, right? you know, right now, doing the virtual machine thing, if you're doing the graphics card pass-through, it's pretty... It's not perfect. You still need a KVM switch. It still kind of feels like you're running two machines. Now, there is a display mirroring program. I think it's called Looking Glass that they're developing, where it will copy virtual memory from the graphics card you have passed through the virtual machine to the graphics card that's running the desktop OS to make it a little bit better, but that's still pretty early days in development. So you're still running two monitors on your desktop or a KVM and switching between them and multiple keyboards and mice and shit like that. So it's still a little kludgy. You know what I mean?
A hassle.
Yeah, it's a bit of a hassle. I mean, it's you can make it a lot better with like a good KVM switch and things like that. So, anyways, I'm way off topic here. So let's get back on topic. Next article is from Ars Technica. And the headline of this one is the Robinhood ransomware takes down the Baltimore government or city government network.
And who wants to bet they did not have backups?
Systems at a number of Baltimore city government departments were taken offline on May the 7th by a ransomware attack. As of 9 a.m. today, email and other random services or other services remain offline. Police, fire, and emergency response systems have not been affected by the attack, but nearly every other department of the city government has been affected in some way. Calls to the city's Office of Information Technology are being answered by a recording stating, "We are aware that systems are currently down. We are working to resolve the issue as quickly as possible."
Well, you're looking for a new position. Less, no, I think there's going to be a position open.
I don't know that I want to move to Baltimore, though.
No, I don't either.
Lester Davis, a spokesperson for Baltimore's mayor's office, told the Baltimore Sun's Ian Duncan that the attack was similar to one that hit Greenville, North Carolina in April. Baltimore Chief Information Officer Frank Johnson confirmed in a press... Why do I feel like that's not that guy's real name?
It's not.
Frank Johnson. Could you have a more generic name? There's probably 50 of them in the phone book. confirmed in a press conference today that the malware is a very aggressive Robinhood ransomware and that the FBI has identified it as a fairly new variant of the malware. This new variant of Robinhood emerged over the past month. Security researcher Vital Kermes, who recently reverse-engineered a sample of Robinhood, told ours that the malware appears to target only files on a single system and does not spread through network shares. It is believed to be spread directly to the individual machines via PSXSEC or domain controller compromise, Kermes said. Yeah, that's how a lot of Windows malware spreads anymore, because a lot of the Windows network share malware went away. And anyways, the reason
don't
behind
explain stupid to them.
Sasser and Nimda were a while ago, people. Okay, most people fix their shares after that shit. Not saying it's not still a valid way of spreading malware. It's just not as common. The reasoning behind it is that the ransomware itself does not have any network spreading capabilities and is meant to be deployed for each machine individually. This would mean that the attacker would need to already have gained administrative level access to a system on the network due to the way ransomware interacts with C Windows temp directory, Kermits explained. Exclaimed was better. In addition to requiring execution on each individually targeted machine, want to bet they're imaged and they all have the same damn root username and password? Like, on Windows box would be system, not root, but you know what I mean, or administrator. In addition to requiring execution on each individually targeted machine, Robinhood also requires that a public RSA key already be present on the targeted computer in order to begin encryption of the files. This means that the attacker likely drops it in multiple steps, from obtaining access to the network in question, moving laterally to obtain administrative privileges for a domain controller or via PSXSEC, deploy it and save public RSA keys and ransomware on each machine, and then execute it, Krimitz noted. It's called scripts, dude. I'm certain he didn't do that individually per machine. before it begins encryption, Robinhood malware shuts down all connections to shared networks directories with the net use /delete /s command and then runs through 181 Windows service shutdown commands, including the disabling of multiple malware protection tools, backup agents, and email database IIS servers. I don't know what I just said. I've been drinking. That string of commands, which starts with an attempt to shut down Kaspersky's AVP agent, would create a lot of noise on any management system monitoring Windows system event logs, except almost no one forwards their workstation event logs to a SIM because, my God, the noise. Although on your servers, you probably would. Just over a year ago, Baltimore's 911 system was attacked by ransomware when maintenance on the city's networks briefly left gaps in a firewall. The firewall change was apparently only 4 hours old before the attackers exploited it, likely through an automated scan. Johnson insists that the city's information security provisions have been audited and were up to date. We've been assessed several times since I've been here, and we've gotten multiple clean bills of health. That doesn't mean shit. We also have a very good capability. Unfortunately, it's a race between bad actors and cybersecurity industry. There's so
slightly
many things,
right there.
There are so many things wrong with that statement. But go ahead, Madman.
It's like he is slightly right. It is a race between good guys figuring out how to stop the bad guys and the bad guys doing the workaround. I doubt they're actually doing proper security now because I don't know of a company that does.
Well, he's talking about how they keep getting assessed and having a clean bill of health, right? Do you know how many people I've seen game audits? It's not even fucking hard. The auditors know you're doing it. They just don't care. They're getting paid.
Exactly.
So
I ran this Ethernet cord through this firewall.
By drilling a hole in it.
It's going through a firewall.
I drilled a hole through the firewall with a Dremel, cut the hole myself, ran the cable through the firewall. The data goes through a firewall. I've just passed audit.
I would like to know how much the Baltimore City Council budget actually goes into protecting its IT infrastructure. That would actually be a question if you're a fucking decent reporter you would have put in.
Well, let's finish off the article
and whether
here.
The funding has gone up or down over the last couple of years.
Yeah.
Which of the companies that I've done the
audit. Who are your contractors?
Yeah, and seeing whether they're related to anyone on the fucking council. Do your job, media.
In his press conference, Baltimore's new mayor, Bernard Jack Young, said it was uncertain how long the city systems would be offline. There is a backup system with the IT department, he said, but we can't just go and restore because we don't know how far back the virus goes. So I don't want people to think that Baltimore doesn't have a backup. In the meantime, Young said city's employees would switch to doing things manually. If city workers were idle for a substantial amount of time, Young said that he might ask them to help clean up the city.
They're not going to manually be issued. They're just going to say you can't have a driver's license. The infrastructure to manually do most paperwork doesn't exist anymore. With the exception of some banking, because they haven't updated the regulation in the 70s. There's some manual uses for that, but that's filing, like, deeds. There's nothing saying you couldn't automate driver's licenses or birth certificates. So,
They did.
That shit's gone digital. You're not going to go down to Baltimore right now and be like, hey, I need to update my driver's license unless the DMV wasn't affected. If it was, you're fucked.
Wow. I mean, there's so many questions that this reporter just didn't bother asking.
You're probably not voting either, so.
You know, the Baltimore Sun is a very reputable paper, or they used to be. But, yeah, there's a lot of questions need to be asked.
Well, this is probably one of the same reporters who just accept it when companies or government agents say, yeah, there was a glitch. Okay, what was the glitch? I don't know. There was a glitch. I mean, come on.
The wizard fell off his horse.
We forgot to feed the hamster. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
There was a bug in the mainframe. You'd have seen the sucker was 6 foot tall. Took 4 techs to kill it and drag its corpus out.
I wish that's how it worked. I wish
that's
how
it worked. It used to work. That's where the phrase bug came from.
No, I know, but can you imagine, like, hey, Larry, what are you doing? Wearing the armor today? Yeah, bug catching.
Well, that's what they used to do, is they used to send the secretaries into the mainframe, because the mainframe was big enough to go inside, literally, physically walk into the damn thing, because it was a closet, to go hunt down the bugs that were bridging circuits. So, that is where that term came from. At least that's the common lore around it.
Hey, that's the truth. If it's not, it is now, because it should have been the truth.
Get no argument out of me on that one. So, anyways, let's see. This next one is from Torrent Freak. Judge, IP address doesn't locate or identify a BitTorrent pirate. Strike 3 Holdings has identified hundreds of alleged copyright infringers through U.S. courts. This often happens without much hassle, but this week the company suffered a major setback. Florida District Court Judge Ursula Ungaro refused to issue a subpoena, stating that an IP address evidence is not enough to locate or identify an alleged pirate. Since the start of the decade, hundreds of thousands of alleged BitTorrent pirates have been sued by so-called copyright trolls in the United States. The select group of rights holders that these cases generally rely on an IP address as evidence. Huh? The select group of rights holders that file these. Okay, there we go. That file these generally rely on an IP address as evidence. They then ask the court to grant a subpoena, ordering internet providers to hand over personal details of the associated account holder. While some judges have refused to do so in the past, many district courts still issue these subpoenas. However, over the years, judges have grown more skeptical about the evidence provided evidence. This includes Florida District Court Judge Ursula Ungaro. In February, Judge Ungaro was assigned a case filed by the adult entertainment company Three Strikes Holdings, which has filed hundreds of lawsuits over the past several months. The company accused IP address 72.28.136.217 of sharing its content through BitTorrent without permission. The judge, however, was reluctant to issue a subpoena. She asked the company how the use of geolocation and other technologies could reasonably pinpoint the identity and location of the alleged infringer. Responding to this order to show cause, Strike 3 explained that it used MaxMind's database to link the IP address to the internet provider Conjunco and a location in southern Florida. According to MaxMind, its IP address tracking service is roughly 95% accurate within the United States, so the rights holder is confident that it filed the case in the right court. Strike 3 further admitted that at this point it doesn't know whether the account holder is an actual copyright infringer. However, the company believes that this is the most plausible target and says it will try to find out more once the identity of the person is revealed. Yeah, we'll answer your question as soon as you get me what you want. What we want.
Yeah. We don't even know if this person's broken the law. We have a warrant, please.
Yeah, basically.
Oh.
That was not good. Go ahead.
I'm seeing at least the lore is working.
What's somebody actually examining? Because that has been a problem, is that you have a lot of these judges who just don't understand the technology and they don't even know what an IP address is. So when somebody says, oh, well, this is the address of the bad guy, they're just like, oh, okay. You know, they don't really stop and question and say, wait a minute, how do we know that?
Well, that's what it means. I'm good.
Fairly certain they're not issuing static IPs. Nobody does that. Charges for that.
Yeah, most do.
When a static IP, we charge you extra. So that might have been the IP of Bob 4 months ago. Now the IP of Sue.
So.
Yeah.
That was not good enough for Judge Ungaro. In an order released this week, she writes that other than stating that it's plausible that the infringer can be identified through the IP address, Strike 3 failed to explain how the geolocation software can properly identify or locate the actual infringer. There is nothing that links the IP address location to the identity of the person actually downloading and viewing the plaintiff's videos and establishing whether that person lives in this district, Judge Ungaro writes. Oh, so she's approaching it from a districting question. I don't think you filed it in the right court. Awesome. That's a good, you know, that's a good argument. How do I know this is even in my jurisdiction?
Yeah, good point.
I like it. Yeah, the order points out that an IP address alone can't identify somebody. As such, it can't accurately pinpoint the person who allegedly downloaded the infringing content. For example, it is entirely possible that the IP address belongs to a coffee shop or an open Wi-Fi network, which the alleged infringer briefly used on a visit to Miami, Judge Ungaro notes. Even if the IP address were located within a residence in the district, the geolocation software cannot identify who has access to that resident's computer and who actually used it to infringe on the plaintiff's copyright, she adds. Strike 3 stressed that many courts have issued subpoenas based on the exact same evidence. While this is true, the judge counters that other courts, which also doubted the strength of the IP address's evidence, have refused to do so. In this instance, the court finds that Strike 3 hasn't provided sufficient evidence to argue that it can reasonably rely on the usage of geolocation to establish the identity of the accused downloader, nor does it prove that the person lives in the court's jurisdiction. As a result, the court refused to issue the subpoena and dismissed the case against IP address 7228-136-217 for improper venue. The case is closed and Strike 3 won't get an opportunity to refile, at least not in that district. While not all judges may come to the same conclusion, the order is a setback for Strike 3 and other rights holders. They clearly have to come up with other arguments or evidence if the case is to be handled by this judge. That shouldn't really come as a surprise, as she has ordered, the judge has put in similar orders in the past. I just want to see if that IP comes back with anything other than all the news about it. Yeah, here we go. Who's the who is on this thing? It does come back to Miami Beach, but it also is coming back to an interesting location. The geomap puts it right smack in the middle of the water. So,
oh God, that's my house.
Yeah, I have a feeling that it doesn't know where it actually is. It just that happens to be the, what the geo IP has decided is the center of that region. So, yeah. They know it's in Florida, probably Miami, but again,
Florida man strikes again.
Yeah, I love it though that they're like, "How do I know this IP address is in my jurisdiction?" I think that's fantastic. I think that's a really good question.
Yeah.
So, anyways, last article I have for tonight before we get into Dojo is from CNBC.com. And the picture they have of Joe Biden on this page is just funny. Let's see. A parody website with embarrassing pictures of Joe Biden is outranking his official campaign page on Google. Users are reporting that the former vice president's official 2020 campaign page is nowhere to be found on the first page of results for the search term Joe Biden. Even worse for the Democrat frontrunner, a realistic-looking parody site featuring images of Biden touching women and children appears to be doing quite well on Google and other major search engines, particularly for the search Joe Biden website, which if you search for, at least for me, it was ranked number 2. It was joebiden.info, and this site is fucking hilarious, especially if you don't think very much of Joe Biden, because they've got all these pictures of him like trying to touch women and children, and all these quotes that are having, you know, complete opposite of his actual views.
Oh, the quotes are his actual quotes.
Oh, they've got some of his real quotes too, but like the policy stuff. Like if you look through the policy stuff, you know, it's got a bunch of stuff in there that's like not real, but
well, yeah. It's ranked number 1 on my search now. Yeah,
isn't it? It's hilarious.
Uncle Joe is back.
Oh, I'm not going
to
stop.
He's ready to take a hands-on approach to America's problems. That is so fucking gross.
Down, he talks about the president having a big stick. So. Yeah, it's out there. I just think it's great that somebody's made a parody website. It's you know, ranking better than the real one.
Wow, Joe's legislative accomplishments. That, kicking him right in the dick there.
That whole website's a kick in the dick. I'm not going to... Joe Biden's presidential campaign has already sunk, at least on Google. Users reporting the former vice president's official 2020 campaign page is nowhere to be found on the first page of results for the search term Joe Biden. Even worse for the Democrat frontrunner, a realistic parodying site featuring images of Biden touching women and children appears to be doing quite well. Joe Biden has a good feel for the American people and knows exactly what they want really deep down, reads joebiden.info, the parody site. He's happy to open up and reveal himself to voters and will give a pounding to anybody who gives in his way. Yeah, the whole thing's cringeworthy. And the thing goes on talking about how Biden actually did get a lot of people complaining about his behavior and that that's been a thing. And Yeah, I imagine somebody at Google is going to fix this. There's probably people screaming, fix it, fix it, fix it, fix it, at some poor engineer at Google right now. But it's hilarious.
Great.
Rats, if you got articles you want me to use in the show, it's usually better to send them to me either on Reddit or... you know, drop them in the IRC. I don't normally get on the IRC during the week, but if you do drop them in there, Sard will occasionally see them and send them over to me, and I can see them before the show. I generally don't pick them up during the show just because I haven't had a chance to at least pretend I've glanced at them and picked the right articles. I'm not going to claim I've always done that. Occasionally, I've just picked them based on headline, and then we go do the story, and then I've realize my take on it's really, really wrong. Go back and find the episode where we talk about the guys at Microsoft who have to review all the public posts, because I thought it was an SJW article until we got into it, and I realized I was wrong and felt really bad about it. It's like, oh, no, this is actual PTSD. Fuck.
Oh, yeah. That was bad.
Yeah, and that's what I get for skimming, right? But
I don't know. I must either miss that episode or I've really had too much to drink this week. I have no recollection of what you're talking about.
It was a while ago. It was a long time ago. But you may not have been on that one, are you? I don't know. I know Madman gave me shit for it, though. That may have been after the show.
I fired off on the show. Everyone should hear.
Dude, an article like that on IHN last week.
Yeah, that's what we thought it was similar to, is what some of the stuff we did on IHN where it was SW. It was actual PTSD from needing to... well, the horrible on the internet, computers can't filter out. So, yeah, people have to look at it.
So, yeah, it's pretty bad. But anyways, let's move on to this. First thing I have for you tonight in Digital Dojo is a GitHub page with a whole bunch of Bash one-liners on it. It's got some shortcuts for the Linux terminal. It's got a whole bunch of examples of how to use some of your more common Linux commands. So if you are learning Linux, or if you're... maybe you've been using Linux, but you've never used, say, sed or awk very much. This has a bunch of examples of how to use sed and awk. This has a bunch of good examples of xargs for, you know, just scrolling through here. How to do some basic bash scripting with conditions and loops and things like that. So it's a pretty nice resource for the bash shell. And, yeah, It's kind of basic, but it's a nice cheat sheet to have around, especially if you're still learning the system or you haven't done much on the command line. And then finally, I think this is just amazing. I love this project, and I'm probably going to build one of these, but at the same time, it is so fucking dumb. This is the Pi 1541. And what this is a project with a design for the electrical hookups and the software to properly emulate a Commodore 1541 floppy drive using a Raspberry Pi 3. Not a 0, not a 2, it has to be a 3. The others aren't fast enough. Because it's not just emulating, you know, the disk calls like an SD to IEC does. This thing is fully... This thing is fully emulating the hardware, because I don't expect most people to be aware of this. A Commodore 1541 disk drive is not like most disk drives, even on old school 8-bit machines, right? Because this is for Commodore 64, Commodore PETs, the VIC-20, and even the Commodore 128. So we're talking about 80s 8-bit machines, right? And, of course, anybody who was... Yeah, I got started on a Commodore 64, so I love the things. I've got like 3 of them in a crate over there. But they're just great fun to play with. But what the 1541 disk drive is. Is takes a little bit of explanation. Commodore had their own chip fab. It was MOS technology. So, you know, the SID chip, the processor that went in the Commodore machines, all this stuff, they made their own. Like, they weren't, like most people building 8-bit machines were using a Z80 or the Motorola 6800 processor, like what you had in Apple IIs or the ZX Spectrums, right? So the Commodore made their own damn chips. And their machine was just well enough between an actual computer and a gaming console that it, you know, did fantastic back in the 80s. But their disk drives, they didn't just go out and buy a floppy disk controller like anybody else. And because they didn't want to include a bunch of file system calls in their ROM image for the machine, the disk drive had a whole other computer in it. The 1541 had the same processor as a VIC-20, and the serial connection between the drive and the computer actually has almost as much. It was almost more of a modern networking connection than it was a serial disk drive at the time, because you weren't talking to a floppy and like saying seek to this part on the disk and read sectors. You were sending commands to the operating system running on the disk drive to retrieve files and send them back across the serial link. So what this thing is doing is emulating the processor and the ROM chips on the floppy drive and not just returning the data. So whereas an SD to IEC works with the basic Commodore BASIC and a few of the Jiffy DOS and fast loaders and things like that, this thing is actually completely emulating the hardware. So it should theoretically work with everything. But you are taking a Raspberry Pi 3B or B Plus or even the 3A and using it to emulate the disk drive for a machine that is running a 1 megahertz 8-bit processor. It kind of feels like you've got it backwards, right? When you're using that much, you know, processing grunt. Admittedly, a Raspberry Pi is not, you know, like a high-end computer, right? And they're not expensive. But at the same time, you're comparing relative processing powers. It's almost silly to use this thing to emulate the disk drive for this 8-bit machine. But if you're into 8-bit gaming or retro computing or whatever, I mean, it's how you do it. But I love it. You're grabbing this machine that's multiple thousands of times more compute powerful and using it to emulate the disk drive. I love it. I'm probably going to build one of these things. But at the same time, it's what it is.
Can't see it, but I'm shaking my head in disappointment.
And that's actually a really cool project that somebody has managed to emulate, you know, that hardware to that level.
Talking about a conversation starter. Hey, guess what I've been doing lately?
He's got a YouTube video showing the interface on the Raspi, and it actually shows like what disk sectors the thing is accessing and all this stuff. So from just understanding how these old floppy disks work, I mean, that in itself is cool. But, yeah. So.
Or you go by a DeLorean, go back in time and play with a real Commodore 64. Just as simple.
Well, I mean, you can get them off eBay fairly cheap. And if you really want a real 1541 drive, I mean, you can get them. But good luck. Those disk mechanisms don't last. And, you know, during shipping, they tend to get knocked out of alignment. So, you know, the last time I actually tried to get one and put it together, I ended up having to buy two of them and, you know, swap parts back and forth until I got one to work. So
yeah, but retro gaming's like that, man. If you want to use original hardware, be prepared to open her up and yep. Be prepared for what's inside, especially if you're buying secondhand gear.
Yeah, it's really fun when you open up a secondhand Commodore and just look at all the jumper wires where somebody put some, you know, different ROMs in there and then took them out. Yeah, that's happened.
Well, you open up an old Genesis and find some very interesting shit in there.
That is not how you do an RGB mod. That is not how you do it. Why is there packing tape in there?
I found foreign currencies in some. Like, how?
It's like you epoxied the wires down instead of soldering them. Why would you epoxy them down instead of soldering them? Oh, that guy who does 3D printer videos that I hate, he put out a video talking about how, you don't need to solder the wires. Just twist them together and use some heat shrink over them. It's like, the fuck? What are you doing?
He's having a fucking laugh.
It's like, I mean, yeah, that's good until you get tug on it once. I mean, you know, come on. Anyways. That's all I have for the show tonight. Listen to the stream. We're always working on it. Pure decking every Thursday except for next week. I have something I have to deal with. Of course, the Galaxy 15 Radio site, the subreddit, which is just Galaxy 15 Radio, the IRC. Again, tonight we have myself, Sardonic, Psychros, DPView, Haratz, Iron Angel, and Madman. Do we advertise IHN or not? I still haven't. I need to.
I think we just did, Ben. We haven't posted yet, have we?
No, I need to fix that.
Madman, have you made the email address yet?
I'm actually doing that right now.
Ah, okay. But hopefully this week it'll be our Madman will be more fresh than he was last week. Goddamn Kentucky Derby, man. We should have just canceled the show. But knowing that, that's about it from me. Yeah. No, I don't know, man. We'll do it this Saturday.
All right. Fair enough. Madman.
I already got a little story, so.
Oh, good. Well, I sent Madman one for IHN earlier, too, just because, I mean, I thought it was funny, but it was, what's the email to send in articles? I actually haven't been using an email. I just PM them to me on Reddit, Morps on Reddit. That's the easiest way to get them to me. I will see them if you do that. Let's see. I do need to set up an email address for it at some point. There is the morpsimia at galaxy15radio.com, but I haven't checked that email address like in a year because I haven't done anything with it. So it's probably just completely full of garbage. Madman, closing thoughts.
This site is not going to hurt Biden. Still more than double digits ahead of the next. I don't think he's going to win the primary. He's white. So, going to lose it. But it's not going to be because of the website. Even though it is a good parody
site. I'm a white guy.
All right. Are you closing thoughts?
I don't really have any this week. A little preoccupied looking up how to build a war truck. But that's probably going to get me black bagged.
It's like, no,
I got curious. I stumbled across the dude's channel, like it's not in English, and I'm trying to fumble my way through it. And I got like part one of how to build a war truck. It's actually some dudes in Syria videoing themselves step by step setting out a Toyota war truck. Yeah, I want to find the rest of it.
So are you need to make a distraction for your account, right? So you need to create a Google account. I know you don't want to, but create a Google account, go to Google Docs, and start writing some really bad fan fiction about something that involves a war truck. You won't get black bagged. They'll assume you're just a really bad author.
Either way, man.
It's like, he's going to write the next Twilight books. Never mind, we can leave him alone.
I did give out the URL for this YouTuber, but I want the site to stay up for a little bit longer yet.
Email lets you customize your gender. I didn't mean to cut you off, but that needed to be announced to the world.
If YouTube actually had... if they were doing what they said they're doing with censoring and stuff like that, there's no way this guy's channel would be up because it's... You know how it autoplays that first video?
Yeah.
the gore in that first video, man. Yeah, it would get you kicked off LiveLeak these days. That's how bad it is.
Nice. All right.
That's it.
That's all we got. Get back here Saturday about the same time. We'll do IHN, probably, maybe, or not. If we're not,
I'll do.
We'll hop on the stream and say we're not doing it. But, yep. Anyways.
I've got everything ready to go.
Anyway. Awesome. I'm going to start hitting sounds on the soundboard and close this out.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over.
Down to go nose down and call it a night.
Shut up, Wesley.